welcome to Ride the Omnibus. Today, I am so happy to welcome Jay Jameson, the writer-director of the short film Slave Cry and one of the writers on the upcoming CW series Superman. He's here to discuss with us a lot about his process and his work. Thank you so much for coming today, Jay.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was first really aware of you with Slave Cry, which is incredible.
Thank you. And a very different film from Try.
Very, very different. But I love the perspective that you bring to Slave Cry. I think one of the things that I love most about it is how clearly it's a collaboration of love between you and your sister.
The film Slave Cry kind of came out of... It's a long road to get to Slave Cry, but basically, you know, I kind of grew up in Richmond, working in the Richmond film scene. You know, I just started off making shorts and screening at this thing called Project Resolution, which was like a monthly film show up, show your film, get feedback from other filmmakers. That's where I started collaborating with a lot of the people that I made Slave Cry with. You know, I'd watch their films and say, hey, I really like your film. Let's do something together. So that's where I met Kunioe, who is the director of photography of Slave Cry. I think a previous guest on this,
friend
this
of
the podcast.
Show. Yeah.
And that's where I met Matt West, who is the colorist. That's where I met Charles Bevin, who did some of the special effects and title design. That's where I met Andrew Uvarov, who does sound design. So it's like that collaboration that started, oh my goodness, 15 plus years ago. You know, and just kind of messing around and finding our voices in Richmond. Like, that's where Slave Cry, you know, like the behind the scenes aspect of it started. So I grew up in Richmond, you know, making films, went to grad school at American University, came out, started working on films. The first film I worked on was Lincoln, and then worked on everything I could get my hands on up and down the East Coast. And I just finished working on season 2 of Turn. As a visual effects assistant. The visual effects supervisor is this guy named Terry Wendell, who's just, he was a former director, done a lot of television, a lot of commercials, former animator, and just a sweetheart of a guy. We had so much fun working on that project. But one of the things that stood out to me while I was working on that show is that based on the subject matter, just based on what the show was about, every role that was available to Black actors was a slave. There were occasional read slaves, but like it was all like for the most part, all the day players, like whenever the cast notices came out, all roles were slaves. And that was one of those things where, you know, I spent 5 months working on that project, which everyone there, amazing collaborators, some mentors that I still keep in touch with to this day, some amazing writers working on that project. But just the nature of the fact that almost everything that filmed in Richmond were period pieces, it limited the types of roles that were available to Black actors. Mm-hmm. Around the same time, my sister knew she wanted to be an actor from when she was, you know, young. I think part of it was, you know, she just always had the performance gene. You know, she just kind of always would put on shows and be very performative. And, you know, whenever it was like a family gathering, she would dress up and do like little variety shows and all of that. And then she also saw that I was getting into film. So she was exposed to like me making shorts with my friends and, you know, and seeing that it was a viable way to go, a viable career. So while I'm doing Turn, she is... I think she was in school. I think she was an undergrad at the time at James Madison, studying musical theater. And it was one of those things where I wanted to write a role for my sister that also commented on the state of like making films in Richmond. Because first and foremost, one of my goals has been to tell stories, make film and television in and about Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so the first scene that came to mind was the opening scene, which is an audition scene of a young Black actress going out for this slave role. And it's like this over the top, kind of audition that's just heightened, and the writing is not very good, and it's just, you know, it's basically like this actor going through all of these like melodramatic emotions, and then you cut and like, and you have the panel there, and it's like all white writers and producers. And so that scene stuck in my head from when I was working on Turn. And that was the seed that turned into a pilot that I wrote called RVA. Did you have like a comment on that opening?
I do. I have a lot of comments on that opening because I gotta say, like, I mean, I sort of kind of triple majored in college in Latin and theater. What else? Psychology. Oh, yeah. I knew that. but I was in Williamsburg and I saw a lot of the same kinds of things going on in the theater scene in Williamsburg as well, because we had, you know, the interpreters in colonial Williamsburg who could only be, you know, and we'll get into the interpreters later. But this idea that female performers are always objectified, but in that opening scene, you see the objectification happening at such a horrendous level with this racialized role and then zooming out to this humiliating colorist commentary from these white casting directors. I think a lot of people in the acting world may not necessarily recognize exactly how it works for people of other races and colors. And I think your film does such an excellent job of establishing that right from the get-go. And it's so clear from that opening monologue and the switch that happens.
Thank you. Thank you. It's interesting because and that just reminded me of another for that opening was like a few years prior to me working on Turn, I'd been trying to get another feature film off the ground. This is a film called Little Lake. And a friend of mine wrote it. I was going to direct it. And we did a proof of concept short film. And the idea behind it is that we would do the short film to try to raise money. So we did casting. And the lead is supposed to be a woman of color, a Black woman. But who's just going through her own personal, like, kind of psychological struggles. And usually when I do auditions, I like to have a conversation with the actor just to get a sense of, you know, who they are at their, you know, I don't like to have them just come in and just do the scene. I like to say it like, what's your name? Where are you from? How did you get into acting? You know, what's your background? Like, where did you study? Like all of that. And, you know, we had this casting session. We had a bunch of actors come in and they would come in. And we'd have that conversation and have this amazing, I went to Spelman, I went to UVA, I studied at Juilliard, I did all this stuff. And then when they did the scene, it's like a switch on, and they would affect this like persona that they thought they needed to do. There's nothing in the script that said like where this character came from, besides the fact that we wanted them to be Black. Mm-hmm. And all of these Black actors would turn into something that was not themselves. Mm-hmm. That would, it would be this kind of heightened, like this heightened dialect and this heightened, this is not like what, and I asked like the woman we wound up casting for that short, I was like, why did you, like, everyone did this. Why did you do that? And she said, like, that's what is expected of us. Like, every time we go into an audition, like, they expect us to turn on this kind of quote-unquote urban affectation, even if it's not what the role calls for. Or usually when they're casting that role, it is what they want that role. Because those are the types of roles that are available to Black actors. It's the sassy best friend. It's, you know, so it's like, that was the other side of the coin that I was trying to show with these audition scenes. Because I have the one at the beginning and the one at the end. And so You know, so that was like kind of the seed that was planted for me to write this pilot. As soon as I finished working on season two of Turn, I wrote this pilot called RVA. And that's one of the stories, like the story of Slave Cry is one of the stories in RVA. It's about young Black millennials growing up in Richmond. So there's like a guy who's involved in tech. There's another friend who's like a lawyer. And she's based on my experience of growing up as a kid in Richmond who... Like my friends, like I didn't know any drug dealers growing up. Like my experience was not The Wire, you know, but like I do know friends who are pharmacists and doctors. You know, I didn't have any friends who went to jail, but like one of my friends grew up and became a clerk for the Supreme Court of the United States. So it's like I wanted to tell those stories and in a way that was still entertaining and still showed Richmond as a character and what it meant to be a Black kid in the former capital of the Confederacy. And so I wrote this pilot. Then I got the opportunity to go off and direct try. So that the pilot kind of went in the shelf for, you know, I want to say like 9 months or so while I went off and did this other film. I have all this experience from making this film. You know, I did a rewrite on the script. Like my narrative brain has just expanded. And I was like, let me go take pilot again. And I did some rewrites, and then I was able to go to the Nantucket Screenwriters Colony with that pilot and workshop it there with, you know, these amazing other writers. And then it came out with a really tight pilot. I was like, I'm going to LA. I'm going to sell this thing. I'm going to get people to read it. And it's like, I'm going to get a manager. I'm going to get agents. I'm going to sell this show, or I'm going to get staffed on another TV show and all of this. And like, I couldn't get folks to read the pilot. Just flat out, like I would have these meetings, I'd go into the meeting and within the first 5 minutes, it's like, oh, you didn't read my pilot. You just took this meeting as a favor to your client or a favor to your friend. You didn't do the prep. You're just kind of a general meeting. Like, we don't have anything to talk about. I could tell you my story, but like, you didn't read my work. You didn't. So coming out of that trip to LA and wanting to get back on set, wanting to dive back in to filmmaking and kind of everything that I'd learned from making Try, I wanted to put into my own film because I was like kind of hired and brought on to a project that already existed. I wanted to do something that was like all my own voice, my own story, but everything, all the tools and the reps that I got from making Try, I wanted to put into this film. It was my sister. Between all that stuff happening, my sister was her third year at Yale Drama. And I was like, all right, I can put a crew together. I wrote the role for my sister. I'm going to take just this character from the pilot, take those scenes out and craft a short film that would serve as a proof of concept for the pilot, but also exist on its own as a short film. And that was the impetus of Slave Cry. So this all started you asking me like the collaboration with Courtney. It was like, she was definitely the inspiration. She was, you know, because I wanted to, this all stemmed from me wanting to write a role for her. And then when it came to doing the short film, the hardest thing to really get, like when you're making short films, like the most precious resource is really good actors for the role. Mm-hmm. You know, you can oftentimes production value, you can get, you know, high quality equipment because it's just a couple days. You know, you can rent the equipment, you can get really good crafts people behind the camera, you know, who will come and work and, you know, people who have done a bunch of commercials and worked on big movies and all that. A lot of those people were my friends that, you know, like I said, I met years ago on Project Resolution that I worked with, you know, on Lincoln, on Turn, on commercials. So like I could put the crew together. And then I had like my sister, who is like the ace in the hole, you know, is like the lead of this thing. And then I got with Ann Chapman, who's a phenomenal casting director and collaborator. And we filled out the rest of the cast with just amazing local Richmond actors. And, you know, we were able to make the thing. And then in the process of kind of honing in on what the short film is, Courtney and I definitely had a lot of conversations in terms of diving into what the character's motivation is, what their perspective is. We had a really interesting conversation with one of the actors who pushed back a little bit on the narrative from the standpoint of
which actor, you know, can you or not?
It was one of the actors who played one of the casting director during the casting session. And, you know, his point, which was a very good point, it was like one of those things where it's like we were talking about the narrative, the perspective was there are a lot of actors who have had to take roles and do things that they didn't necessarily want to do. Mm-hmm. Bryan Cranston sold hemorrhoid cream, you know, like in commercials. You know, it's like there are a lot of, there's this aspect of like paying dues, and you know, and the whole overall narrative of the film Slave Cry is this actor choosing not to go out for these demeaning roles anymore. It's like, what is my representation? What is my legacy as a black body on the screen? And what am I putting out? What am I furthering? What is my legacy? And so that perspective of like, there is this idea of paying dues, like you shouldn't, and that actually, you know, I was like, that's actually a good point, but I feel like this is different. And that forced me to kind of go into the script and pinpoint that nuance and that difference. And she mentions it in the conversation with.
She does. And I love that you included that to make it explicitly clear that as an actress, you might be forced to take certain kinds of roles, you know, but then you always have to question it and question yourself. And there's always a point at which you cannot go any further, right?
Exactly. And it's like, the line is like, there's paying dues and then there's a poll tax.
Yeah.
You know, this feels like a poll tax.
I love the way you expressed that in that one line. That's so great.
Thank you. And that was, again, that was one of those things where it's like the collaboration with the actors. It's like talking about the material and getting outside perspectives, because to me it was very clear, but it wasn't clear to everyone. And then that kind of conversation forced me to hone in and be more specific and more explicit with the nuance, the message that I'm trying to put out there. Overall, just the collaboration with Courtney was fantastic. You know, she had a large hand in, you know, working with Jenny McGurk, our costume designer, you know, working together with her to like kind of help guide the look and like what she was wearing and all of that. And, you know, so it was great. It was working with my sister. We get along really well. We have all the same references. So on set, it's like our shorthand is crazy. Like literally she would finish my sentence and be like, yeah, you know, I was thinking this take, you could do a little bit more. Like, yeah, okay, good, cool. Got it. You know, it's like, it was fantastic. So
that's gotta be such a luxury in the industry, I would imagine.
It is. I mean, we grew up watching the same stuff and we have a similar sense of humor. So when I write things, she gets the tempo and the tone that I'm going for without me having to really do anything. I totally understand now why directors find an actor that they like and they just keep working with that actor over and over. Like, I understand why Martin Scorsese just works with DiCaprio all the time. I get it. Like, I totally understand. Cause it's like, once you get that shorthand locked in, it makes your life so much easier on set.
I would imagine it's great. And it's just funny because when I was watching this, I so assumed that Courtney had been through these casting directing experiences herself and that she had kind of shared with you a lot about exactly what that experience was, not so much that you necessarily had taken it away from your experiences in casting. So it's very interesting to know that you were on the other side of the table and writing from her perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, let me tell you, being an actor is one of the bravest profession, like in the arts. Like, I just, having to put yourself out there time and time again and just open yourself up and be open to the material and to the world. Like, I have so much respect and empathy for actors. And that was one of the things, like when I started casting films, it's like, it's definitely something where it's like, I have tremendous amounts of empathy for what those actors do and the prep that goes into just giving. And you may not back, especially with self-tapes now, you know, you send this thing out into the ether and you just don't know if you'll ever hear anything back after putting like hours of work and putting your expending creative energy and not getting that energy like returned, you know, like when you're acting on set, like when you're acting, when you have the job and you're acting on set, you're acting on a play, that energy is it, you're putting it out, but then you're getting it back from the audience. You're getting it back from your, the person you're acting with. You're getting it back from the director. You're, you know, it's like, it's a cycle, but like when you're just going out and auditioning and you're not getting that back, it's like draining. And so seeing, being on the other side of the table and seeing what these actors put themselves through, that's definitely where, you know, a lot of the inspiration for this originally came from. And then it's funny because, like, after we made Slave Cry, Courtney started going on a bunch of auditions and had, like, she would call me up. She's like, I had a Slave Cry audition today. Like, it was like, it was similar to Slave Cry. And I was like, oh no, like, you know, so, or her friends would tell, you know, would tell me. And then it was funny because a lot of the actors, when they read the script, they understood. Like, they had all been in, like, all the working actors, the actress at the end of the, in the final scene, Felicia, she read the script and she was like, I know exactly what the scene is. I've been in this before. I know what both of these scenes are.
Can you describe that final scene just for people who haven't seen the film?
For sure. The opening scene is our lead going out for, it's a slave television series, like a Civil War television series where she would play a slave. And, you know, we see that audition. Then she kind of questions what she's doing in the industry, like questions the roles that are available to her. We find out that, like, her day job, which we'll probably get to soon, but her day job is she gives tours of the monuments in Richmond, which is, you know, problematic for her, but that's her day job, is how she puts food on the table. And she has a conversation with her grandfather about what are the things I'm putting out into the world? Like, what is the, like, this isn't what I went to school for. You know, like, I didn't go to school to play these demeaning roles, to just experience trauma on camera.
Mm-hmm.
So then kind of she's marinating on the advice that her grandfather gives her, which is to listen in. It's like, this is your legacy. So it's like, when you do this work, it's going to exist. And it's up to you to decide what type of image and representation you want to put into the world. And so she kind of takes that and she goes in for another audition at the end. And this is the audition this time is for the sassy best friend. She meets this other young Black actor in the waiting room. They just have a moment. They bond, you know, over what it's like to be working in Richmond as actors, as trained actors. You know, one of them went to NYU grad school. One of them went to Juilliard. She had seen her in this performance of Macbeth. Like, one had seen the other, and was like, "You were amazing." And then, you know, our lead, the young woman our lead's talking to, gets called into her audition, and our lead's left in the waiting room. You can overhear the audition taking place from the other room. And as she's listening, she's hearing this young woman, poised, intelligent, trained young woman that she just had a conversation with, turn on the quote-unquote urban affectation and become Chinakwa, which is the character, is kind of this caricature of the sassy best friend. And as she's giving her audition, our lead, we just kind of stay on our lead as she's listening to this performance. And then she starts kind of miming along or lip syncing along to the performance because she knows it so well. It's the game that she's played. It's the, when you talk about the code switch, it's the code switch that actors often have to do. That's beyond the normal code switch of like what it is to society. It's like another level of that. It's putting on the mask. And in that moment, the whole weight of all of these roles and everything that she's gone through kind of lands on her. And she makes the decision to not do the audition, to walk out, to not take this, because that's not the type of representation or legacy that she wants to put out to the world. So that was, you know, when folks, like, especially with Black actors, read, especially regional Black actors who've been working in the Richmond, Maryland, DC area,
location specific to a certain degree.
Yeah. So it was heartening that I was able to capture in a realistic way what all of these folks have been through. At the same time, very disappointing. I was able to, like, that this was the experience that I was capturing, which is part of the reason I made the film. I wanted to make the film as a commentary to make folks look in the mirror and really grasp, like, all right, what is we are putting out there into the world and why.
Now, there's one thing you said about kind of the audition process earlier, where you were talking about how through the audition process and through, you know, that first miniseries that she's auditioning for, she's re-experiencing racial trauma through that first miniseries as it's being recorded. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot. And in terms of the acting experience, I'm not sure if you necessarily can speak to this just based on what you know of your sister's experiences. But when we're talking now about generational racial trauma that's sort of inherited, you know, we're now starting to get a better sense of how epigenetics have been passed down through generations. We're starting to understand the way that racial trauma plays out when everybody is watching these videos of horrible things happening on the news and the television. But I have to imagine, as an actor physically trying to put those things into your body, it would be so much worse. And I feel like that in and of itself is something that I'd kind of like to talk about for a minute. Like, have you personally worked on programs where you've had conversations about this phenomenon?
Oh, I mean, I'll tell you from Slave Cry, like it was, so the opening scene, the original version of that was an absurdist kind of Monty Python even-esque, maybe not to that extreme, but like very like funny. Because the idea behind the original scene is that you come in and you don't know that it's an audition initially. Like the whole idea is like you think you're coming in on an actual slave movie that's very poorly written. Like, that was the whole point of it, is that it's like melodramatic and over the top and, you know, does not have the depth that these stories usually require. And, you know, and then you realize that, like, at some point you realize that it's an audition scene that's like where they have her in costume and they have like fake cotton, like in the wind and a fan blowing it like she's outdoors and all that, and like, and it, you know, you cut around and here's the panel of white folks behind a table judging whether or not she was believable enough as a slave, you know, and like that kind of absurdist commentary supposed to be funnier. I mean, still biting and still, but funnier. But when we actually filmed the scene, you know, that's when I wasn't prepared for like how serious it was going to get. And by that, I mean, we're setting up to film the scene. My sister comes up to me and she says, is it okay if I name my son? Cause the whole scene that's taking place, like the fake scene that's written is she's a mother whose son is being sold away, and she's pleading with her master, her owner, to not sell her son away. Like, and that's the scene. It's like this traumatic, very traumatic thing. And I didn't name the son. I just, please don't take my son away from me. This is, and my sister's like, I came over. She's like, is it okay if I named him? I named him William. I'm like, yeah, whatever's your process. And that's when I realized, like, in order for actors to be good, to really do the work, and I'm not talking about like, you don't have to be method. You don't have to like live as this character for the entire film. Like, I've thoughts on like acting and all that, so like, you know, it's like, but in order for you to be good, when the scene is playing, you have to live in that moment. Mm-hmm. You have to do the prep, you have to do the research, and you have to live in that, you have to be present in that moment. And so my sister prepping And then being present in the moment and going into that mindset and crying real tears because she emotionally put herself in that space. It was a crazy experience for me because it's like I'm literally putting my sister through trauma. You know what I'm saying? I realized in the moment, and it was like, and all of a sudden, like, the set was very, like, prior to that, the set was very loose and very, like, it's a bunch of friends having a good time, and we're just, you know, we're doing the thing, you know? And then when we started filming her coverage of that scene, I was like, oh, wow. No, this is serious. No more messing around, because we're doing this in as few takes as possible. You know, because I am not going to sit here and continuously put my sister through trauma over and over and over again. And then that opened my mind to what these actors are going through when they are playing these roles. What they're unlocking and the nature of, like, why do these roles exist? Why do we need another slave film? Mm-hmm. Why do we need a film that's about pain and oppression and trauma? And the fact that, like, Black bodies have to experience 2 to 3 times trauma for white audiences to have the same amount of empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the empathy gap. It's the idea that, like, and then not only that, but, like, Black characters have to be 2 to 3 times as impressive or as perfect to be seen as, it's that's the Sidney Poitier of it all, right? Yeah. Like, that's for so many years. Yeah. So that was, you know, so the opening scene where it's like, it's still like a funny moment. Like, I wound up cutting out like some of the quips from the panel. I you know, that kind of made it more like lean more towards funny. I you know, so that it's more like the humor, the laugh is like the release of tension of like, oh wait, this is an audition. And then, you know, a little bit of the conversation, but it's like way more serious because in the process of making the film, I also, like, through my sister, experienced that trauma. So it's like, I definitely understand, like, what that means when we're having these conversations about these other films. You know, I think I read somewhere that, like, it took, like, I don't know if Lupita still has recovered from 12 Years a Slave. Yeah, like, I know it's like years later she had an article where it's like, it took forever. Like, I think Michael B. Jordan, even after playing Killmonger in Black Panther, had to go to therapy. Like, it's the thing where it's after, like, when you start in...
Oh, and I was going to say, also after playing Oscar Grant in Fruitvale Station, too. I mean, although that was even for a Black director, but, you know, in both cases.
No, it's...
But it's still very visceral, very real.
It is. It is. And it's the thing where it's like, and it's both of those cases. It's like, the process of going through this work, we have to be careful and cognizant of how we are presenting this stuff. Whereas like Ryan Coogler, when he's doing that, is very careful and supportive in terms of like working with his actors. Steve McQueen, even with 12 Years a Slave, but it's just the very nature of him, vicious that story is and has one that is traumatizing. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that's my thing where it's like, I feel like, you know, I don't necessarily know if we need any more slave movies, but that's just me. You know?
Yeah. Well, I feel like we've had so many over so many years, and what are we trying to continue to say about slavery at this point? I mean,
it's really like
hasn't been said.
Not much. My addendum is like, I feel like there should just be two more. There should be a Frederick Douglass biopic because like that dude's life was amazing. And then there should be a Robert Smalls movie, which I feel like people are in the process of putting that together. But that dude's story is also amazing. And not necessarily, like, both of those stories have trauma in them, but the trauma isn't the story. Mm-hmm. And that's a key demarcation. Usually with these slavery films, the trauma is the story.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I strive to put things out that are more ultimately more uplifting, that are more like beautiful, that are more positive, that, you know. So, but yeah, if we don't have any more slave movies, I wouldn't necessarily shed a tear about that.
I mean, I think a certain generation definitely grew up on Roots and was traumatized enough just by that one alone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, reading the book is even more traumatizing, I think, than the series. But it's still an interesting concept when you think about the way that trauma plays out in media, both written and watched and performed. And it's a very strange world we live in where people want to see that.
It is. It really is. I don't always understand it, but you know, part of the thing is like one of my goals with Slave Cry was I had hoped that like, if you saw it, you would think twice about trying to make your own movie or think twice about the way that you went about doing it. And thankfully, you know, and another goal with like /RVA was to get other stories told in Richmond that were not necessarily period pieces, because I want to make stuff in Virginia, and there's so many stories about Virginia that I, you know, that need to be told. And like, since then, you know, Homeland filmed a season there. I worked on Swagger, which is an Apple Plus show about youth basketball culture, written, directed, executive produced by Reggie Rock Bythewood. So like that, like, things are coming. I mean, I'll even take Walking Dead. I'll take things that are not, as long as it's not a period piece, as long as there are opportunities for actors of color to play something that is not necessarily a slave or a servant or a sassy best friend.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I've been talking about on this podcast, you know, when we've been discussing books, is just wanting material where characters are Black just to be Black. Not, you know, to comment on racial issues or to be representative of something. We've been talking a lot about specific authors like Octavia Butler and N.K. Jemisin and a lot of their works in the realm of sci-fi that we would like to see made into something. And it's interesting because you still don't see that as much as you would like to in any genre.
No, that's real. But I will say that there are a lot more things in development happening recently. You know, there's some, like, there are kind of just being out here in LA and like talking to folks. It's like there's a lot more momentum in that direction. It just takes a while for the machine to, you know, to get it out. It takes a while, especially now with, you know, production and lockdown and COVID of it all. But like, you know, I think in the next couple of years we will be getting more. I don't know, you know, it's a start, but you know, I don't know if it's ideal yet, but you know, it's a start.
A start is always better than nothing.
Absolutely.
And when you talk about filming projects around Richmond, it makes me think of so many things that Richmond is kind of a haven for a lot of kids I know that I've taught over the years because of VCU or MCV, all these other initialisms as well.
Yes.
I mean, Richmond is literally a city that saved my father's life at one point. And I have gone there every year with students and always had to fight with other teachers when they tried to explain how our hotel was in the bad side of Richmond and the kids couldn't cross the street to go to the subway because something bad might happen. And I'm like, no, it's not, because this is Richmond.
Yeah.
We're in a perfectly fine neighborhood, and stop it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you have this weird tension in that area of Virginia that I don't know what it's like now living there.
I mean, that's one of the things. Yeah. Like, I've been in LA you know, last year I was like back and forth because I was working on Swagger, which films in Richmond, but, you know, writes and does posts in LA. So I was like back and forth all last year. And then as of like November, January, I've just been in LA. I planned on going back in April when we had our hiatus from Superman, but of course, COVID. But it's been interesting watching from afar, you know, and like through my friends and through like a lot of the independent journalists who are doing great work on the ground there via Twitter, and just kind of getting a feel for, I mean, it's rapid, like it's changing rapidly. Richmond is. And it's interesting because there's always been this tension. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I wanted to write this pilot and make Richmond a character, because there's just this, it's this weird mix of people. It's this weird mix of like, you'll go to a bar and in the same bar there will be like just old money private school khakis and vests and polos and loafers. And then there will be like tattooed like art kids who spend all their time at Crossroads and bike and go down to the river. And then there'll be like the Richmond hip hop scene that like, you know, has a whole different vibe. And then, and it's just, it's like, it's this weird cross section of culture that is like a lot of folks who come from out of town to film, like on, you know, crew who have filmed all world and crew who have filmed all over the U.S., people from L.A., from New York, a lot of them Richmond, like they really look into like maybe getting a house, maybe moving to Richmond.
Yeah.
And they say it reminded them of Austin, Texas, like 20 years ago. Like there's just this really interesting like culture, art, music, film vibe that comes from this mixing and tension between the different facets of the city and the different cultural elements and the clash between history and progress and legacy, like the different variations of legacy and like discovering like what they can be and, you know, what they want to be. And yeah, so it's just like, I think a lot of what's happening now is all of that tension is now resulting in rapid change, like all at once. It's like, you know, getting to the monuments, which I know is like, yeah, you know, you wanted to talk about.
That's a big item for me. So.
Yeah. So, you know, so one of the, you know, I mentioned earlier, one of the things I talked about in the film, you know, the role, like one of the roles that that the lead character McKinley has, like her day job is she gives tours of the Confederate monuments in Richmond, and she does so, and she has to like wear period costume, like similar to, you know, how they do in Colonial Williamsburg. You know, we see on the first tour, it's a bus full of like people visiting from overseas who are like, we're going to go see the sites, and they don't necessarily know what they're seeing. They just see this big monument and they're taking a picture of it because it's impressive. It's the Robert E. Lee Monument is an impressive monument. It's big. It's like well-made. It's just an impressive piece of art, just objectively. And I've had this really like interesting relationship with that monument since, you know, like I said, I grew up in Richmond and I went to Fox Elementary School, which is in Van. And I would drive by that monument every morning. My mom would drive by it every morning, dropping me off at school. And when I was like 5, 6, 7 years old, you see this picture of this man on a horse. And it's this majestic thing. And it's literally an edification of this person that you just assume is a great person, a great man. Someone to be remembered and someone to be idolized, someone to look to as a role model for yourself. Because maybe you too will be given some sort of statue. Like, because that's all, like, all a lot of what human beings look for is some sort of legacy, some sort of way of saying, like, I mattered, I existed, I'm putting this out into the world because I mattered. And so this person got that. He got a big giant statue so that everyone knows who he is through history. So that he met, like, that's mankind's one of our needs, one of our existential needs is to feel like we matter. And so when you're a kid, you see this, you're like, oh. And then I asked my mom, and my mom was telling me recently, she's like, yeah, I didn't know you. I just kind of hemmed and hawed and, like, you know, moved on, changed the subject. But then you see this man, and eventually you go to history class. And the thing is like, in Richmond, those history classes are still skewed. Oh, like, yeah. I went to one of the best high schools in the country. Maggie Walker.
You went to Maggie Governor Walker. School.
I went to Maggie Walker school. Governor School.
That is the it's greatest a great school. School.
It's a great school. I went to the most essential. I was in the most essential class of Maggie Walker of Governor School, because we had 2 years at Thomas Jefferson and we had 2 years at Maggie Walker. So we were the bridge. Wow. Between TJ and Maggie Walker. But even that history skewed, like, I realized recently, like, a lot of my preconceived notions and, like, a lot of, like, my thoughts on, like, the Civil War and stuff. Like, I know more about battles of the Civil War and, like, why the South, like, won or lost a specific battle based on supply chains and based on, like, all this stuff. Like, we knew, like, we were taught in Richmond was just so skewed. But even still, I'm looking at these monuments at 5 years old. I eventually learn why he had a monument, like who he was and what he was fighting for. And as a young Black kid growing up in Richmond, that cognitive dissonance is something that, like, it's like all of a sudden finding out that, like, you know, I don't know, Santa Claus is an evil person who wants to, like, enslave you, which in some cultures, apparently he is. But like, it's like, and so then all of a sudden that monument was taunting me. And it's the thing where it's like, a lot of people around the monument debate have been like, why is this just coming up now? I made my first film, like, I made another film with my sister when she was in high school and I was in grad school, that was a precursor to Slave Cry. It was like the prototype for Slave Cry, about the monument. It was a debate about the Lee monument and why it was there, when it was like this young high schooler talking to her councilman. And that was one of my films I made at this point 10 years ago. And I've been actively pushing against and working against the Lee monument and the Confederate monuments in Richmond for over 10 years. And I know other people who have been. The thing is, people who are saying, like, why is this just an issue just now? It's always been an issue. You're just now listening. It's just now, like, other people are just now listening. And the idea that, like, these monuments have never done anything to you, like, they don't understand the weight of that oppression that we're living with every day because of what those monuments represent. It represents people putting up this lost cause narrative. Mm-hmm. Claiming their place as being better than another group of people, saying that you don't belong in Richmond because this is what Richmond represents. It represents this man who fought to preserve slavery, who captured freed slaves as contraband, and or captured free Black folks, not even freed slaves, but free Black folks, sold them into slavery, whipped his own slaves, and poured brine on them. Like, Robert E. Lee was not a good person by any stretch of any imagination. So
but he's a Southern gentleman.
He suppose yes. Well, I mean, that's if that's what a Southern gentleman is, then I do not want to be a Southern gentleman. You know, like, that's the it's so to have those monuments there. And so that's why it's like when the when everything started happening, you know, my sister and I were watching from LA, like, the live streams we were watching on, you know, our phones, on Twitter, we were just like, we wish we could be there. You know, we're taking this pandemic very seriously. We're you know, we're limiting exposure and stuff, but I would have been out and about in Richmond promote like supporting those folks who were taking those monuments down. Because it's like, when you talk about what they mean, and this also plays into the film, right? So there's another moment in the film where McKinley goes to the Maggie Walker monument,
yeah,
the Maggie Walker statue, which is on Broad Street,
I love that that was built in time for you guys to shoot it, that that statue was placed there, because it's a gorgeous statue. And Maggie Walker is like such a hero. I mean,
yeah,
the first African-American woman to be like a bank president and to charter a bank. I mean, in like, you know,
in the first woman,
where who would have thought it? And, you know,
yeah,
it's just incredible everything she achieved.
Absolutely. And the way that she used her position to uplift others.
Yeah.
Like she, her whole mission was to help other people, uplift them, and to provide opportunities for them to better themselves.
Yeah.
And her statue is majestic. It's like, it's someone who looks like my aunts. It's someone who looks like one of my teachers when I was like a kid. It's someone who looks like a member of my community. And to have that person there. And I remember the first time, and so this is where it's like, the first time I went to see that statue when it was built, I think I was out of town when they unveiled it. And, you know, I was working on a film project. So I walked up to it and I spent some time there, and the peace that came over me, I started crying. It was like a weight was lifted from my city, like from this place. I love Richmond. Like, you will not find anyone who loves and represents Richmond more than me, maybe as much as me, maybe more vocal than me, but not as much as me. Like, I rep Richmond, I rep Virginia as much as possible. The reason I'm in LA right now is so I can build up as many credits and connections so I can start bringing TV shows and films back to Virginia, back to Richmond. Like, that's my goal. And so to have this city that I love, have this this representation of this proud Black woman, mm-hmm. it lifted this weight off of me. And that's when I knew the damage, the psychological damage, day by day, just a little bit, a little bit here, a little bit there, of having those Confederate monuments everywhere. It's not a bullet. You know, it's a river. It's a river that slowly wears down the mountain. That's what those Confederate monuments are. And so it's like, you have to understand, it's not like, oh, they haven't done anything. Yes, they have. There's a psychological toll that takes place to having the edification of these men who committed evil acts. Like, there's a psychological toll. So when they started coming down, when they started getting repurposed, and when people started putting new art on them and taking the space back, that energy is amazing. And like, that's what Richmond is. That's the promise of what Richmond could be. You know, like, that's the space that, like, I saw. That's the image that I saw, is we are taking this city to the next step. We are allowing the city to grow, because it's growing pains. There are going to be growing pains, but in order to get to the beautiful place that I see it can be, this is what needed to happen. And so, yeah, so Maggie Walker monument, it's beautiful. So we wrote a scene into the film where, you know, the lead is kind of communing with the monument. There's another longer scene where she interacts with like a little girl and kind of explains who Maggie Walker was. And I really love that scene. It's just one of those things where it's like production realities. We had limited time, and that was the thing that wound up getting cut from being able to film it. Like, if I had filmed it, I would have figured out a way to put it into the movie. But yeah, so that's my big monument rant.
Wow. It's something else, because those monuments on Monument Avenue in Richmond, for listeners who've never been to Richmond, I just want to say, every time you go down that street, it is incredibly imposing, and it is the only thing anyone ever thinks about when you go down that street. Because I have gone down that street with my students every year for the 15 years I've been teaching, and every time they ask me, why are there so many monuments here? Why are they celebrating these guys? What are these guys? You know, and then I have to explain. And then you have to make a choice of exactly how angry you are allowed to be in your tone while you explain. And I just can't even imagine what it means as a Black person in that space. And I thank you so much for sharing that story with me, because like I was literally crying when I was watching the movie the first time. And she has that whole rant about Robert E. Lee and, you know, goes into actually saying who he was and what would have happened if he had fought for the North. And because that is something that I've literally had going, not those words specifically, those are much cleverer words than I would probably think of in my head while I'm on the tour bus with the kids, but something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that's like, these men were traitors, like beyond the slavery of it all, which is a huge part, to be sure, but they were traitors. Like they, if, and this is the line that you're referring to, like in the film, it's like, if Robert E. Lee, the one thing I'll give him, dude was pretty good with the with strategy. He was a pretty good strategist, you know, given like what he had, resources and whatnot. If he had fought for the North, the war wouldn't have lasted nearly as long. And I think they estimated it would have saved between 200 and 300,000 lives. So it's like, you know, it's like, what, why are we edifying this person? Why are we putting him up on, literally up on a pedestal? And then my final Monument Avenue thing, people are upset about the Arthur Ashe monument as well. I am too. I think it's a terrible monument. I think he should be on Monument Avenue. I think we just need a new monument that does not look like he's beating children with the tennis racket.
I agree. It's so funny.
It's like, so it's, bad.
I've always thought that monument was so strange. Like,
it's not good. I get the attempt, but it was like, it's one of the rare things where like when that monument went up on Monument Avenue, no one was happy about it. Like the people, yeah. Like the people who loved the Confederate monuments, they hated it, and then all the Black folks also hated it. It was just like, so I'm just like, let's take that one down. Just take all of them down. Let's start over. Let's just, it's a great opportunity to just start over. Get some amazing artists. Like Richmond has a thing where every year they invite world-renowned street artists to come to Richmond and paint murals on various buildings and walls. And they're beautiful. I mean, we're talking world. Like there are images in Richmond that are on blogs around the world that are world-renowned. We have one of the top contemporary art museums in the world that just opened up. And we have the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, which is one of the top museums in the world.
VMFA.
I was a 2008 VMFA fellow for film and video. Like, shout out to VMFA. I was, awesome. Yes.
The VMFA is legit one of my favorite museums of all time. Probably my favorite regional museum anywhere in the country. And I've been to a lot of them.
It's one of those things where it's like when you went there as a kid on your field trips, like you took it for granted, you know, because it's just there. It's just, we're just drive by it all the time.
You took it for granted as a kid.
And then you take like art history classes and there's some painting and they're like courtesy of the VMFA. And you're like, oh, this is a very famous painting that's in my hometown. That's very, very cool. But we have all of, we have the number one sculpture school in the world at VCU. We have like amazing arts and culture. Use Monument Avenue as an opportunity to expand upon that, and let's create inclusive art. Let's keep it as a national historical landmark with new inclusive art that represents the culture, the moment, and where we are going, not stuck on racist symbols of the past of where we have been.
No, I think that's an excellent point, because Richmond is very much a city of art and the arts as a whole. And I think utilizing that creativity as much as possible is essential going forward.
For sure.
And I love what you're doing in terms of your creativity, in terms of the way that you structured this piece around the monuments. I just, you know, talk about timely. You know, I saw that you said in an article that you really wanted them to, like, leave the monuments alone just long enough for you to make the TV show.
No, because, like, yeah, like, when I filmed this, it was, like, the conversation. Like, I wrote the first draft of this before the national conversation around monuments was really happening. And then between that point and when I filmed, Charlottesville happened. And that's when the conversation around, like, maybe we should take these things down really kind of started up in earnest. And, like, some cities started taking their monuments mm-hmm. down. And that's when I was like, all right, well, you know, I'd be happy. I'm happy if they take them down. I would love to get my film done first, but I would be happier if they, you know, took them down in the long run. But I did get the film made, but now they're coming down, you know, and you know, although now with, like, Robert E. Lee, it's like, I kind of want it to, like, I'm torn because it's like, now it represents something so much more, so much different. That part of me kind of wants it to stay. But also it's like, leave the pedestal with all the art and then put the other thing in a museum or, you know, whatever.
That's always the question. Like, I mean, I've traveled around the world into different places where there have been different forms of genocide and so forth. And there's always that question of, do you keep the thing that represents the most hateful group or, you know, whatever form of hate speech there is in that culture? And, you know, do you contextualize it within a museum or do you leave it in situ and then have tourists go, oh, what is that? And then you say, oh, well, that's from when the Germans came in and wanted to say that the Jews were like pigs. And so that's why that's on the corner of the cathedral. And, you know, but are you okay with that? Are you okay with that being there?
No, I definitely, like, my big thing is put them in a museum or, you know, some sort of, like, put them on, like, a battlefield and, like, rope that off. Let that be the thing. The argument, you know, that you hear about, like, oh, but it's going to destroy history. It's like, what is rewriting? It's like, no, like, first of all, you've already rewritten history. It's called the Lost Cause narrative. Like, secondly, books, like, there are no statues of, like, plenty of things from history. I still know those things from history. You know what I'm saying? Like, the statues are literally edificate. It's literally you saying these people were worthy and honorable men. You don't put up statues of evil normally, unless there's a lost cause narrative, which means you've already written history. You know, one example that was like of repurposing. And the reason when I was looking at the idea of repurposing, I remember, so I studied in Prague for 6 months. I studied at FAMU, the Czech Film Academy. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was, because they were, you know, they were behind the Iron Curtain for a long time. And I remember there's this giant tower in Žižkov, which is like a section of Prague. Mm-hmm. And it was built as a radio jammer. Like, it was built to block airwaves from the West, like, to block culture, to block. And so then when with the fall of the Soviet Union and all of that, an artist put these sculptures of babies crawling up the tower. Mm-hmm. So instead of tearing the tower down, turned into an art installation and repurposed it.
Yeah.
But in that case, you know, they repurposed the building, the radio jammer, to just be a radio station or a television station, like, antenna. So it was like, it had a purpose. It had, like, a practical utilitarian purpose that they then, like, added an extra degree of, like, art installation to, like, kind of change what it was. But there's no purpose. There's no utilitarian purpose to these monuments. Like, they don't, you know, they don't provide any public service beyond being edifications of evil men.
Yeah. And, you know, and when you compare it to Rome. And then there's always the question of, I think what a lot of people are concerned about is, are we doing as the Romans did and doing the damnatio memoriae and just canceling them from history and so on and so forth and pretending they just never happened? And I don't think anyone's actually advocating for that anywhere. And I think that's such a false argument.
I don't think we're going to forget about those folks. I think we just need to put them in their proper context and give them the proper amount of attention and headspace, which is just enough to remember that they were vile, evil people who fought on the side of slavery and tore our country apart. And let's hope we don't go through that again. And then that's the end of it. That's the long and short of it. That's all we need to know about them. I don't need to know what the name of his horse was. I don't need to know that his horse's name was Traveler. I don't need to know that. I don't need to know that after the war he went to and was the president of Washington and Lee. I don't need to know that Stonewall Jackson used to like have Sunday school for slaves. Like, I don't need to know all that stuff about them. This is all stuff I unfortunately do know because I grew up in Richmond and this is the nature of history teaching.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I didn't learn about like Black history or culture until I went to college and beyond. So it's like, that's what I'm saying. It's like the amount of energy and time that we spend on these people needs to be minimized.
I find it so horribly offensive that when I went to school, we studied the Battle of Antietam for maybe a week. And then we spent maybe 2 days on the 60s. I mean, yeah, tell me how that's reasonable.
it's crazy. So, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm glad what's happening there is happening in terms of the monuments. I'm glad they're coming down. I cheered when Stonewall came down. I watched it. I watched every minute of it, of the live stream. When the order came out that they were coming down, I literally jumped in my apartment. I literally jumped and screamed. I was excited. It was like a weight was lifted off. So I'm glad they're coming down. They can go to a museum or a battlefield or a theme park called like Second Place Trophy Land or Loserville or whatever it is. But as far as I'm concerned, if I never see a Confederate monument again, I will. Died a happy man.
I think that's awesome. Let's make Jay's dreams come true.
Let's do it.
So speaking of dreams coming true, your new role right
now. It's a hell of a segue.
I know, right? I'm so good.
That's a hell of a segue.
I had to do it somehow.
I mean, I love it. I just had to call that out.
So in terms of working on your new project, you are now focused on Superman for Superman and Lois for the CW coming out in January. And before I ask you about this specific show, I want to know, where do you think your hunger for stories and comic books really started?
Growing up, I just always loved reading. Like, I just like escaping to other worlds, learning about different people, you know, graphic novels, books, Hardy Boy mysteries. That was great illustrated classics. I don't know if you remember those, but it was like,
it was like
young adult versions of like Frankenstein and Three Musketeers and all that. Like, you know, as a kid, just consuming all sorts of media. And, you know, I think a lot of it came from, you know, it was escapism. It was like, as someone who kind of didn't quite fit between worlds, where it was like, I went to private school, or I would hang out with these folks. And like, I grew up in a decently well-off privileged household. So it's like, a lot of times I was like, too Black for the white kids, or too white for the Black kids, or, you know, like whatever that means, you know, like I kind of reject those things now a little bit, but like, that's just the shorthand for how to describe that experience at the time. And so I would escape to these stories where, you know, and especially I read a lot of like science fiction and fantasy and comic books where it's just like other like ways to kind of take the everyday problems and like look at them through a new lens, or ways to like look at new characters and all of that. So yeah, I mean, I've always loved comic books. My first one was the one that I remember just really getting me into it was Giant Size X-Men #1. Chris Claremont and Jim Lee.
Of course.
Saw it at a Food Lion. I remember this. I remember walking through Food Lion, seeing that cover, and I was like, I want that. And I got it. And then that was from that point on, it was like I was a comic book fiend. Like, you know, at one point I had a habit that was like $200 to $300 a month of comic books. I eventually quit cold turkey. I was just like, I can't afford this. What's cool now is that because I work for Superman, I get, you know, as research and stuff, I can, you know, I have a thing where it's like I get to read all the DC comics, which has just been great. So I've just been diving back into my love. But yeah, so I grew up mostly like, you know, Marvel, X-Men, you know, but mm-hmm. then I think Superman was my first hero that I loved. Like, I remember watching, like, you know, I'm 4 or 5 years old, even before I read the X-Men comics. Like, I remember watching the old, like, cartoons, you know, mm-hmm. like the old cartoons. And, you know, I watched, like, the movie, like, the Donner films and Lois and Clark, you know, on ABC, and like, yep. you know, and so it's like, you know, there's a video somewhere that we need to track down. It's on a VHS. I don't know. It's somewhere, but like, it's of me 5 years old dressed as Superman singing, "I've been working on the railroad."
Aww.
You know, I know that's what my mom says every time she thinks about it. I'm like, that's this exact tone of voice. So, but yeah, so like Superman's always been, you know, an amazing character that I've been a fan of, but also a very difficult character to pull off sometimes because he's so powerful.
How on earth do you write for someone who's so OP? Like, he's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, the thing that makes Superman interesting, and this is the thing about our take on the show, is that it's interesting to me when he's dealing with problems that he can't punch, where Superman is given two bad options and finds a third option. You know, like that's the essence and core to me of a good Superman story. It's he represents hope. He represents potential. He represents the best of us. You know, it's an immigrant story. It's like Superman is who he is because he was taken in by this couple who built into him these values of empathy, of you are no better than anyone else and no one else is better than you. Like, of understanding other people, other cultures, of trying to be the best and do the best and always take up these things into consideration. And I think, you know, our narrative is about Superman, Lois, and their two kids. And, you know, and being a dad presents a lot of problems that you cannot punch. It's him figuring that stuff out while also being Superman and saving the world and, you know, being the global hero, the paragon of hope. So, you know, so that's what, you know, kind of excited me about this take. And, you know, it's just being able to lend my voice, like even a little bit, to the canon of this character who's been around for almost 100 years is just something that is like, I relish it. I'm so kind of blown away by this like opportunity. Like, this is my first like television writing gig, like my first staff writing gig. I'm working on just this iconic character. It's pretty amazing.
That is superb. I mean, it's got to be crazy exciting. And to do it, though, in this particular way, in this environment, must feel really weird to achieve your goal with COVID and to, like, be writing episodes not in a typical writer's room situation. And
yeah, a lot of Zoom rooming. I was fortunate in the fact that we started in February. So I had like 2.5-3 weeks in the room with the staff. So we got to like know each other a little bit, see each other, like do all of that before we went to the Zoom room. But even still, everyone on the staff is just some of the best people. You definitely, like, everyone's just excited to be there. Everyone is aware of the weight of the character and the responsibility of the character, but excited just to tell good stories about family and hope. And that we think that, you know, for a lot of us, this thing has been keeping us going through all of this. You know, having the routine of, you know, I know I'm going to see these folks every day and we're going to talk about story. They're good people that I really like. And then secondly, the stories that we're telling, you know, when we get on the air, they're going to be hopeful, uplifting stories about, you know, family and what it means to try to be the best that you can be and be good to other people. And like, that's exciting. That's exciting for me.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful that you're doing good work on that show and that everybody actually has something to look forward to in terms of creative content in January, because I know so many people are so, so eager for it. So,
yeah. We all are as well. We're just like, can't wait to start getting dailies back and just seeing how this thing that's living in all of our heads, like, see what it turns into.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming and having a chat. And I enjoyed this conversation. I hope thank you'll you. Consider I did as well. Coming back and talking I will. To us later. So
yeah, maybe once some episodes start airing, I can come and talk a little bit more about like what actually is going on Superman, because I can't.
Yeah, there's I know, only so I know much I can give right away right now. Obviously. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Likewise.